This is what was needed. This is the green light to start. Okay, so we start the next session of the workshop, and we start with Jan trying to demystify that dark matter is just a Z prime in the S channel. So please, Jan, go ahead.
Z prime in the S channel. Yeah, exactly. You already looked into my slides. Yeah, thanks a lot for having me here. I will give you a phenomenological perspective on dark matter, and try to motivate a little bit that if you look into T-channel mediators, MET searches are probably not the way to go at the LHC, but it's very likely actually that we might see long-lived particles at the LHC when we talk about dark matter. Exactly. This is the S channel and the T channel mediator models. I think in general, dark matter is one of the main motivations, I think, for looking for new physics. And although there are, of course, plenty of ways to couple dark matter to the standard model, the way these searches were interpreted by the LHC collaborations were mainly in terms of simplified models, where you really look into the low energy degrees of freedom of a certain theory and look, and there are basically these two options, an S-channel and a T-channel mediator. And a T-channel mediator in particular is very interesting because it has a quite rich phenomenology. And although you typically might think of it, as I said, as some low energy degrees of freedom of a more complete theory, in principle, these models are consistent in the way that they are renormalizable gauge theories where you can write down a mass term and everything is fine in principle. Now in the MSS, what you basically do is to introduce a dark matter particle and some partner that is also out on the Z2 symmetry that stabilizes dark matter. And here we have the SUSY example where you as a dark matter and a scalar quark partner as the mediator. And there you would have this Yukawa type interaction that you see down here. And in the MSSM, this coupling would be given by the gauge coupling, which is of course not the case in general. Also in the in extensions to the MSSM, this might be a free parameter. Some time ago, people started to study these kind of models in a more systematic way. For instance, collaborators of mine who really went out and studied all the different spin assignments and coupling to the various generations of quarks and studied the constraints on such models. If you really take these low energy degrees of freedom as all that there is relevant for the phenomenology and do the relic density computation, indirect and direct detection constraints, and look what actually remains. And it's surprisingly little that remains. So here's the case of the SUSY-like T-channel mediator model, where you have this Mariana fermion dark matter and a scalar mediator, and this is parameter space in terms of the dark matter mass and the relative mass splitting between that mediator and dark matter. And the gray shading is here the coupling that you would need to get the right relic density. You have several constraints, and you see shockingly few little spots that are still allowed, and these unfortunately are not really very much in the reach of LHC. So so you might think it's a good idea to look for these models at the LHC at all. And it's even worse if you look into other choices. For instance, if you look into non-self-conjugate dark matter, then you see actually that all of the parameter space with the size of a coupling, so in the WIMP region, is actually excluded by all the searches without the LHC already. However, there's this white spot down here, which for all these models is actually untouched by all these constraints. And you might wonder what happens there. So technically, the coupling should be very small in this region. So let us see what happens there. And to understand this, let us very briefly just review, what happens. What is actually the dependence of the relic density on this coupling lambda chi? that I introduce. So in the usual freeze out scenario that all of you probably know, where you have large couplings, you have just this annihilation of dark matter that governs the radic density. So the radic density is just inversely proportional to some power of the coupling. However, depending on the mass splitting between the mediator and that dark matter particle, actually significant contribution from mediator pair annihilation or this co-annihilation can play a role in the freeze out. So this curve actually bends down, and in the case of sufficiently small couplings, it's just the mediator pair annihilation that is important in the early universe. And in this case, the radic density is actually not dependent on this coupling anymore. However, if you reach a certain smallness of this coupling, another process is actually important, which typically is assumed to be efficient, but it's not for very small couplings, namely the conversion between dark matter and this mediator particle. Once these conversions are not efficient anymore, or at the edge of being efficient, they can actually initiate the breakdown of chemical equilibrium. So they can actually govern the freeze out. And that's a distinct freeze out mode, which we call conversion driven freeze out or co-scattering. And that's hence another phenomenological distinct region. And if you want to know where this sits, I mean, you can have probably already guess. But let me just show you this curve again for some particular mass point and the radic density that we measured, 0.12. If they end up like this, you clearly find this WIMP solution for the radic density. So you were basically sitting here. However, if the curve looks like this, so for another point in the mass parameter plane, you may find a region here, and this is exactly in this white region down here where you get a solution for the radic density for this conversion-driven freeze-out region. And you might also be at this plateau, which corresponds basically to this boundary here, where the coupling actually drops by orders of magnitude. Why is it important for the LHC? Now, because this conversion-driven freeze-out really predicts long-lived particles at the LHC with typical lifetimes or decay lengths of basically, well, millimeters to meters, so roughly a few centimeters typically. And that's because if conversions should be of the order of the Hubble rate, which means that they are in the edge of being efficient, the decays, which are just one part of the conversions, should be of the order of the Hubble rate or smaller. That means the decay length is of the order or larger than the inverse Hubble rate, which you can translate actually into centimeters for typical freeze-out temperatures. So for these TEF scale particles that we can probe at the LHC, we naturally have these long-lived particles. And that's why in all these white spots, the way to look into is long-lived particles. So there's one more thing to the story, namely, there's been recent progress in the radic density computation, meaning that we further looked into bound state effects that are, I mean, known to be potentially important in these sorts of models because you have this colored mediator particle and they can form bound states. However, for this very small mass gaps, so in this conversion-driven freeze-out region, you have a prolonged freeze-out process. So it's not an instantaneous one. So these bound state effects are actually super important there. And well, you can of course read our papers, it's very interesting, but I mean, the upshot and what is important for us here is that the region where you have this, basically this long-lived particle, so this white region down here, which looks a bit different here because we are plotting it linearly. So this is the mass splitting again, and this is the dark matter mass. So this region here is actually pretty much enhanced. So this is a just perturbative computation for this boundary between the WIMP region and the conversion-driven freeze-out region. And this is actually the solution if we take into account bound states and even excited bound states. So this endpoint in particular goes from 1 point, say 3 or so TeV to 4 TeV. So yeah, this is a quite large rate.
Yeah, and 3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay, yeah. Thank you. So how would you look into these long-lived particles at the LHC? So here in this case, it's called a particle that could be pair-produced. They could typically decay inside the detector into a soft jet and in dark matter. And here I would like to highlight that this is a softish jet that the signature somehow falls a little bit into the between the typical targets that are looked for at the LHC. So typically you either look into something like split SUSY, where you have a hardened from a gluino that then decays into relatively hard jets in a displaced vertex, or you look into something like a Chargino that decays into a super soft pion, like hundreds of MeV just, and missing energy. But this is something like the soft jet has something like a typical energy of this delta M, so say 20, 40, maybe 50 GeV. So this actually we found that neither the displaced vertices search nor the disappearing track search is really targeted to this kind of scenario, although this is a this is basically what comes out if you look into this T-channel models. And of course, once in a while, depending on the exact lifetime, it could also traverse all of the detector and so gives us a highly ionizing track. And this is the current LLP constraints that we examined here for very small mass splittings. So this is the bottom partner. So if it's below the bottom threshold, there this two-body decay is suppressed. So here we really have detector-stable particles. We can directly interpret the Arden searches for these kind of searches. Here we had to reinterpret them, and this is what we would for disappearing tracks. And based vertices searches actually suffered a lot from an invariant mass cut that was imposed in the experimental setup that basically killed our sensitivity for this rather softish jets. So there's still quite some room to be explored here. Okay, I think my time is up. I just want to flash, of course. I mean, there's this this 1.4 TeV heavy saber chargeable particle excess with a mass of 1.4 most likely, which of course fits very well here in principle, and you see also the importance of these effects. But I mean, we have discussed this on Tuesday. Clearly there's something that points to maybe something more weird than that, but I just wanted to flash how, I mean, that in principle from the cross section that we expect here, this would fit very well if only one would see it in the time of flight measurement. So very, very briefly my summary. So the upshot is really that T-channel mediator models, the WIM parameter space is almost excluded. The remaining region is the convergent freeze-out region, which is less explored, but gives us really as a prediction, not just in some corner of it, long-lived particles at the LHC, which can be looked for. And we've seen that these bound state effects actually largely enhance this region where we expect LLPs. And the kinematics differ from the one that is currently looked into. So the targets either split SUSY or Chargenos that decay into very soft pions. This is maybe something that could be looked into more dedicatedly. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention. And sorry for probably going over time.
Thanks, Jan, for this talk. I think 1 minute is okay. And then we open the floor for questions. Okay, so let me ask myself something. So you said that although the signature-wise, you would say like disappearing track should work, there's a cut in there that is making the search not very effective for your setup. Now, did you look into the disappearing track? Because probably that cat is removing some unwanted background. So is it somehow clear from a naive estimation that if you remove this cat, then you will gain sensitivity, or is really the best that the disappearing track can give you?
No, this is displaced vertices. So the
okay.
This is a displaced vertices search, and well, we made this exercise. Maybe you even remember that because we discussed it at some point. So the thing is that actually most of our signal is in that region below this 10 GeV cut. So if we were able to completely remove this cut, we would actually gain, I think, 2 or 3 orders of magnitude in our signal. So this is, I think, worth looking into. Of course, there's a reason why it was placed in the first place. However, as far as we could see, there's not really much background. So you can easily put it down to 5 GeV, as far as I understand. You can, of course, also play, because, I mean, you put it there because you want to get rid of background from B mes and stuff like that. But you could, of course, play around with having a somewhat tighter cut on the displacement. So require slightly larger displacement, but reduce that delta, that invariant mass cut. I think this is something that's worth playing around with. So what we've seen from the signal point of view, this is really what kills the signal in this case. And okay. I don't have the plot here, but I mean, the sensitivity was really, I mean, if you would remove it, I think the sensitivity would be something like here. And without it, it's basically, it's hidden here.
No, I get it. Okay. Thank you very much. So in view of time, we'll move to our next speaker. We thank Jan again.
Thank you.
And we have Andre.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Can you try to share your screen?
Absolutely.
When Jan stops sharing.
I just have to goddamn. Because I got rid of the, I think here it is, right?
There we go.
Andre, can you try now?
Yes, I can. There we go. Can we all see this?
And it look is fine. Yeah, perfect. So can you try to go back and forth one? Perfect. Okay, so without further ado, now Andre is going to tell us about inelastic dark matter at the LSE experiments. Please go ahead. I'll let you know when you have 2 minutes left.
Perfect. Thank you. So I'll be discussing a recent study we've just completed regarding inelastic dark matter in the context of future proposed experiments at the LHC. So brief overview. Basically, we try and do our best to survey the landscape, basically utilizing a few of the proposed detector geometries, some of which have been discussed this week, in the context of a standard inelastic dark matter setup. We'll be extending some work that's been previously done by Felix Kling and collaborators in the sense of updated detector parameters, as well as just new experiments being proposed as they come online. So just a brief motivation. So inelastic dark matter consists of effectively almost degenerate mass states. And so it was seen that this sort of setup led to suppressed dark matter nuclei couplings. And so this can help us start to evade direct detection constraints, which are currently getting very strong. Furthermore, correlations in the early universe can determine and set the relic abundance, which is then at later times suppressed. And so we can simultaneously evade stringent CMB constraints while also producing a stable thermal relic, which we denote chi1, rather inventively. And so a relatively light mediator is then required to explain the dark matter abundance via standard thermal freeze-out processes. And the one we choose is the, of course, no surprise, the standard dark photon. And so to set up our model, we consider a dark sector containing, as I mentioned, two almost degenerate mass states coupled through a dark photon mediator, the strength of which is given in this term here by a kinetic mixing parameter epsilon. And so we consider a couple of cases. First, we consider fermionic states. And so we have Majorana fermions with a vertex coupling to the dark photon like this. We consider a scalar case. And of course, the relevant vertex for our phenomenology is going to be how our states couple through this dark photon to the standard model, given like so. And so I've highlighted our kinetic mixing here, which will be eventually what we constrain as a model parameter. The next parameter of interest is going to be this term delta, which is basically proportional to the mass splitting, where I've hired the mass of the lighter state, so our stable dark matter candidate, and this is going to be the other model parameter we constrain. Okay, so epsilon M1 are the parameters of interest here. Okay, so production. The dominant production occurs through Drellian, through some Z boson or the dark photon into our inelastic states here. This heavier state, chi2, then propagates off and then probably decays through either an off-shell or on-shell dark photon into some fermionic final states, which should hopefully be picked up by our detector. Okay, just going into some detail here about how we conduct the analysis. It's a very straightforward analysis. Of course, the main ingredient is going to be the expected number of signal events we expect to see. And this is, of course, proportional to the production cross-section of our chi1, chi2 states from proton-proton collisions, multiplied by some integrated luminosity and some parameter, which I've called F signal, which is basically the expectation of the detector efficiency multiplied by the probability of our heavy inelastic state decaying within the detector volume. And so functionally, this is computed by averaging over all of the possible kinematic configurations of our heavier state using Madgraf. And so again, getting slightly more into this, the piece of interest here, this probability, is given by this combination of exponential terms here. Of note is this L bar, which is just the expected decay length, which is of course inversely proportional to the decay width of the process. This L entry and L exit here are just simply the entry and exit points of our detector volume, assuming the long-lived particle basically travels from the interaction point straight through the detector and doesn't decay in there. And so schematically, I've got a little picture here. We calculate this L entry and L exit by simulating Monte Carlo realizations of our decay process and then determining the three momentum trajectories like so. Furthermore, the other kind of important thing to note is we impose then a detector dependent energy cut on these final state fermions here, which is just the total cut on the total visible energy of the particles, basically preparing for any detector energy thresholds that we might have in the future. We'll discuss a little bit about that later. So that's the schematic setup. Okay, so as far as the experiments we consider, here's a cartoon. So a bunch of these, as I mentioned, have been discussed at length this week. So we have Methuselah, Facet, Codex B, MAP, both MAP 1 and 2, Phaser, Anubis, and Alex here. As far as the numerical implementation of these geometries, we took basically the most recent and up-to-date values we could find in the proposals in the literature and implemented them as best we can. Okay, keeping things brief, moving on to some results. So here we have the forecasted 95% confidence interval limits on the fermionic case. Basically, these contours correspond to an upward Poisson fluctuation of three events in the absence of any significant background contribution. We have four benchmarks corresponding to different values of this mass splitting parameter delta and the ratio of the dark photon mass to the lighter particle mass here. And so, as we can see, the colored contours correspond to the projected sensitivities in each of these experiments. We can carve out quite a significant chunk of the currently unexplored parameter space here, which is nice. The Alex detector being especially good, which was interesting to see. Some things to notice, the forecasted sensitivities move to higher values of the kinetic mixing and the mass when we decrease our mass splitting parameter here by an order of magnitude. This is basically due to the fact that the decay width goes as basically this delta to the power 5. And so to produce the same number of particles, we need to increase the coupling strength and the mass. So this was expected. The gray regions correspond to current experimental constraints on the dark photon. And finally, just for completeness, we include a contour, this black line here in each of these plots that correspond to the case where the stable dark matter candidate, this chi 1, saturates the observed relic abundance. So for the scalar case, we found basically the same result. And so just for demonstration, we plot the first benchmark here. This could pretty much be explained by the fact that the decay length for the scalar and the fermionic case were observed to be approximately the same. And so this was somewhat interesting, but pretty much expected. Something else we observed was the effect of changing this energy cut that we imposed for each detector. And so what we've done here on this plot is we show the case for Methuselah and phasor 2. And this was just basically done to demonstrate examples of an off-axis compared with a forward detector. And so we can see that changing the energy threshold by about a GeV in Methuselah, so an off-axis type proposal, could actually significantly change the forecasted sensitivity, something that we certainly didn't appreciate before doing this. And that's it, short, sharp, and shiny. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andre, for this nice talk. And we open the floor for questions. Okay, so if not, I will use my chair powers to ask you something. So it's just a curiosity. Maybe you didn't look into it. But since you have a chi 2 that decays to chi 1 FF bar, for instance, in Matus or in Codex B or whatever, this should differ from the, let's say, normal benchmark of a scalar that decays into FS bar because of the three-body decay. So you don't see one of these guys, but it would look not really looking like a scalar that decay. So I don't know if you look into sort of some variables of the FS bar decays in case you say, if there's a signal, I should be able to say, this looks more like an elastic dark matter than a scalar decaying, or?
No, we didn't. But this is certainly a good idea and a good proposal to look at.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, it's just curiosity, you know, because at some point we will see signals and we need to characterize them. So mm-hmm. not keep doing exclusion plots. Okay, yep. So let me see if someone else in the meantime got inspired to ask a question. Since it doesn't seem to be the case, we thank Andre again. And now we move to Nathan, that is going to tell us about some quirky stuff.
Yes, hello.
Hello. Sure. Can you try to share your slides?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So please go ahead. I will let you know when you have 3 minutes left.
All right, 1 second. All right, okay. Hello, my name is Nathan, sorry. I am a student at Caltech. I am currently working at the Lauritsen Laboratory for High Energy Physics, and today I'll be talking about my work on a standalone search for quirk pair production with timing detector at the High Lumi LHC. Now, to begin, let's actually go into what quirks are. So quirks are actually a proposed heavy stable charge particle, a dark sector analog to standard model quirks that are connected by a flux tube of dark gluons. Now, to actually properly understand what quirks are, let us go through a little thought experiment. So in the standard model QCD case, the mass of the quirk is much less than the confining scale of QCD. However, in the dark or quirk proposed QCD case, the mass of the quirk is much greater than the dark confining scale. So what are the actual implications of this? So in the standard model case, as we all know, the flux tube of gluon breaks and the leads to radiation into lighter quarks. However, stable quarks do not have any lighter states that maintain quantum numbers. Therefore, the flux tube of dark gluons does not break, as we can see here at the bottom. And this actually causes macroscopic oscillatory motion and eventual annihilation. So a very striking signature indeed. So the actual search regime that we are looking at is in this lambda dark, or the dark confining scale between 100 electron volts to 10 kilo electron volts. This correlates to an oscillation amplitude on the order of 0.1 to 10 centimeters. And this is a search currently constrained by the JETS plus MET search. But as we know, in general, any current searches are limited by standard trigger acceptances. Therefore, the use of any additional kinematic data may improve our reach, as we will see soon. So what actually are the quirk dynamics? Or what is the nature, the kinematic natures of the trajectories of these very unusual particles? So the linked quirk anti-quirk pairs oscillate while moving outward from an initial collision, as we can see here on the right. Now, the interaction with the inner detector does not change the angular momentum of the quirk system. So this actually leads to the quirks having not only an oscillatory motion, but a planar oscillation. And as we know, current reconstruction algorithms are designed to look for helical trajectories. However, with these planar oscillations with quirks, they don't really work that well. So the current reconstruction algorithms are not designed to handle this very striking signature. However, a full redesign of the current reconstruction algorithms to handle this system is unfeasible. Therefore, we try to look for indirect methods at probing the quirk systems and the quirk signal. So this is what leads us to our first search strategy of time delay. So in this case, time delay refers to the difference between a particle, in this case a quirk, reaching a specific region of the detector, so difference between that and a luminal particle. So on the left, we see a little schematic of the, in black, a quirk trajectory, and in orange, just a luminal particle going straight from the interaction point. Now, the background, the standard model background, should generally have some distribution peaked at zero with some small spread. But the quirk signal is expected to have time delays greater than or on the order of 1 nanosecond. So already quite distinct from the standard model background. And this is because quirks are, as we mentioned earlier, these oscillating heavy masses, which are going to travel slowly and reach the point in the detector, as you can see on the left, much slower than just a luminal particle. So how are we actually going to look at the timing layer, or how are we actually going to probe time delay as a discriminant? Fortunately, CMS, my lab actually is a collaborator on this, is designing a minimum ionizing particle timing detector layer, which is a 4 millimeter timing detector layer proposed between the tracker and ECAL region, designed for charged particles. It currently boasts a proposed timing resolution of 30 picoseconds. For note, the BTL region, or the barrel timing layer, is using LISO crystals activated with cerium, read out with silicon photomultipliers. And the ETL, or the NCAP timing layer, uses radiation tolerant silicon sensors with gain known as LGADs. So before we actually get into the timing delay study, we actually need to generate the quirk Monte Carlo simulations. So to do that, as I mentioned earlier, there are two free parameters in the quirk model, the mass of the quirk and the dark confining scale. So my simulations are done in a scan of this parameter space, the mass of the quirk going from 500 GeV to 2500 GeV, and lambda dark going from 100 electron volts to 3 kilo electron volts. The actual model used with MadGraph is VLQ_UFO, which is an extension of the standard model with vector-like top partners. As I mentioned earlier, quarks are these vector-like fermions, these heavy stable charged particles. So we can actually use this T-type quark in this model as a proxy for quarks. Now, the samples are generated with 0 to 1 extra jets, and the quark evolution is done through a self-made code base. And at right, we can see some sample quark trajectories from the simulations showing the characteristic oscillatory motion. Now, this actually gets us into the actual time delay investigation. So here we actually see the time delay distributions for the BTL region. So the BTL being the barrel timing layer. On left, we see the 100 electron volt case for lambda dark and mass of the quark being 1000 GeV. And on right, we see 3 kilo electron volts for the lambda dark and the 1000 GeVs for the mass of the quark. At the bottom, we actually see the topologies of the event. So for the 100 electron volt case, you have the larger versions of these oscillation amplitudes as the quark kind of moves out from its original production point. And at right, we have, actually interestingly enough, the 3 kilo electron volt in the high lambda dark region has small oscillation amplitudes. And to actually reach the BTL later, you actually need to have the pair system recoil off of a jet. So in the 100 EV case, you're going to have the time delay distribution peaked at 2 nanoseconds. And in the right case, you see the time delay being approximately 17.5 nanoseconds. Again, because quarks are these heavy oscillating particles, that's why you have this larger time delay even in the 3K EV region when it's recoiling off of a jet. So the BTL region actually yields greater time delay statistics in the low lambda dark region, as we see compared to the 100 EV or the, or sorry, as you compare to the high, the high lambda dark region of 3 kilo electron volts. So to actually compare to the ETL region, here are the distributions. At left again, we have the 100 EV case, and at right, the 3 kilo electron volt case. The time delay is approximately the same order of magnitude, with time delay being 2.5 nanoseconds on the left, 12 nanoseconds on the right. Note that the ETL yields greater time delay stats in the high lambda dark region. However, the overall time delay is, as you saw on the previous slide, higher in the right plot with the BTL region. So now that we actually understand or saw some time delay distributions, we can go into the actual the numbers, the numerics, the quantitative measurements. And here is the actual geometric cut. So these are the acceptances used to make the previous slide, where we're requiring at least one quark to reach the specified layer, either the BTL or ETL, after a center of mass time greater than 12.5 nanoseconds. So as we can see, the general trend of this table is that higher quark masses yield lower signal efficiencies, with the exception being the low lambda dark region. And in general, upholding the trends from the previous two slides, the BTL region is better for probing the low lambda dark region, and the ETL is better for probing the high lambda dark region. Now that we actually understand the acceptances, we can actually try to implement a kinematic cut. Here we apply a timing cut of 3 nanosecond to time delay cutoff applied to all events passing that geometric acceptance on the previous slide. So here the BTL region maintains more signal efficiency, the general trend is that the BTL region maintains more signal efficiency after the timing cut. But in general, we actually do achieve high signal efficiency greater than 95% for both the BTL and ETL regions, for lambda dark being greater than or equal to 825 EV. In general, as I previously mentioned, the BTL region does maintain more signal efficiency, especially above masses of 1000 GeV, but that's not to say the ETL is poorly performing. So this search of actually looking at the quark systems represents a departure of simply probing the electroweak breaking scale and moving towards looking at unique or striking signatures that are potentially observable at the LHC, but are currently missable because of differences in our workflow, especially in this case, the reconstruction algorithms. Quark trajectories in this project were successfully simulated, and the signal events were generated using MadGraph. Time delay actually proved to be a valuable discriminant for the quark signal, motivating the use of the MTD, both the BTL and ETL separately. As we saw, the BTL proved more effective in probing the low lambda dark regime, while the ETL proved more effective in probing the high lambda dark regime. Currently, we are exploring plane fitting seeded by timing hits as an additional discriminant. Plane fitting naturally is a pretty obvious idea. As I mentioned earlier, quark systems have these planar oscillations. Therefore, it is natural to try to consider a plane fitting aptitude approach. We are also currently determining and generating possible backgrounds to the quark signal for the timing investigation. That would most likely be a soft QCD simulation with a finite MTD timing resolution. And then we want also like to expand the analysis into investigating other quirk signatures. So currently we're only looking at quirks produced through Jellian processes, which allows us to have these standard model electric charge. And that allows us to use the MTD, which is requires us to use charged particles. But if we are clever, we can potentially expand the analysis into other cases, maybe even using like plane fitting aptitude example, to look at the other production methods, such as the colored cases from QCD or even one charge, one neutral. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Nathan. So yes, actually we open the floor for questions. So James has a question. And no, Mike has a question. Please, Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Very interesting. But I have a question. So presumably the quirks will, they've got electric charge and they'll be radiating photons, right? And going, so, and if one is annihilated, the other one's got to be annihilated at the same time. I don't quite understand what's going on there.
Oh, I guess, so do you mean, are you asking about like the topology of the event or?
Well, as I understand it, the quirks are charged. They're the end of a string of this string of dark gluons, right?
Right.
But as they charge, as they are oscillating and turning around at the end, they must be radiating photons because charged particles radiate photons, right? So that will they will cascade down and then annihilate, presumably, on each other,
correct.
Right? Okay. So,
but not Mike. They don't need to radiate photons. So they could be electric. They could be SU2 charged, but they could only be color charged, if you want. Or under a new, they could be totally standard model neutral and charged under the new sort of dark QCD. So this is a matter of model building, if you want.
Okay, but could they radiate dark photons as they're accelerated at the ends of the?
Oscillation. They could, maybe Matt wants to comment more on that because it's the next question, so I let him comment.
Well, I was just gonna, I mean, there's a whole slew of different types of objects here, so I think there's no real one size fits all answer to Mike's question, but generally these particles take a long time to annihilate because the amount of radiation compared to their mass is so small. So on the time scale that the speaker is worried about, the annihilation is not an issue. But I do think it's worth keeping in mind that because there are all these different types of objects, that there are some risks with plane fitting in that, you know, that'll work for some models, but a lot of models it won't. Whereas you haven't mentioned DEDX, which works for a wide class of models. And I wonder whether you're planning to sort of incorporate that.
Yes, actually we are. I didn't mention it, but that is a potential direction that we are looking into.
Thanks.
Okay, so Simon?
Hi Matt, just commenting on the DDX. This is something that when we were looking at the plane fitting back in the day, we did look at, but it wasn't as good as we thought it was gonna be just because of the varying speed in the trajectories. Because you end up picking up the particle at a particular point and a particular velocity. And so you get a very wide distribution for these things, at least for these sort of very broad trajectories. And it didn't end up sticking out much above the background. Now, if the quirk is very narrow, right, so then it should work very well. But that was just like a theorist level study back in the day. So it might be worth revisiting.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Okay, thanks, Simon, for the comment. I see no further questions or comments or hands up. So we thank Nathan again and we move to Rafael.
Yes, hello.
Hello. Okay. We see you. That's fine. Can you try to share your slides? Perfect. So, at boards. And let's see if you can go one forward and one backward. Perfect. So without further ado.
You see them changing?
Yes, yes, fantastic. So please go ahead, Rafa, and tell us everything about charged LLPs. They have been discussed a bit in this question.
Yes. Hello everyone. My name is Rafał Masełek. I'm a PhD student at the University of Warsaw. And today I would like to present you results of a recent study I did together with Mohammad Altakash, Priyanka Lamba, Vasiliki Mitso, and Kazuki Sakurai. If you'd be interested, then you can find the prep in the archive. In our study, we wanted to answer the question whether LLPs can be discovered at LHC during Grand 3 and High Lumi case. And we decided to concentrate on long-lived particles that are multiply charged. By multiply charged, I mean that they are electrically charged, and the magnitude of their charge can be up to several times magnitude of proton's charge or electrons. Now, in our study, we recasted analyses for three experiments, ATLAS, CMS, and MEDAL. And we considered two production modes, both open and closed channel production, where by closed channel, I mean a formation of positronium-like bound states. And we aimed at obtaining lower mass bounds that these three experiments could provide at the end of data taking periods. So there are multiple scenarios that predict existence of multiply charged particles. And in some of them, these particles can be long-lived. In our study, we wanted to be very general, model independent. We considered particles with charges from 1 to 8 times elementary charge that were of four types. So we considered particles with spin 0 and half that were either color singlet or triplet. They were always SU2 singlets. And we added them on top of the standard model. But since we wanted to stay as model independent and general as possible, we didn't like specify their how they would decay. Rather, we treat them as collider stable in case of ATLAS and CMS, or we parameterize their decay length for MEDAL. But how these particles can be produced? Well, there are several processes. There is an S-channel Drellian production. There is a photon fusion through T-channel or a four-point interaction vertex. And in case of color triplet particles, we can also have a gluon-gluon and gamma-gluon fusion processes. On the next slide, you can see the composition of cross-section for an example particle, colored fermion with 1 TeV mass. Here is on x-axis, you can see charge of a particle, on y-axis cross-section. And from this plot, you can see that while for small charges, we have a gluon fusion production and it's dominant, to a larger magnitude of charge, then photon fusion and photon gluon fusion processes become non-negligible. And I speak about it because so far experimental searches interpret the results only for Drellian processes. However, I heard a very interesting talk by Mr. Smirnov 2 days ago about an ongoing ATLAS analysis where they finally take into account also photon fusion. In case of a color singlet, the effect is also very large. Drellian and gamma is the green one. Don't neglect this for highly charged particles. On the next slide, you can see production cross-section for all those four types of particles. I just want you to notice that the production cross-section increases significantly when we increase the charge. In case of color particles, this can mean orders of magnitude change. In addition to considering pairs of particles, particle-antiparticle pairs produced that propagate through the detector, we also considered formation of positronium-like bound states made of those new particles. And we calculated this the production cross-section for these using a non-relativistic approximation. Potential put in the Schrödinger equation, we were able to obtain hydrogen atom-like solutions. Then we use now with approximation to get cross-section to produce such bound state that gammas. Since I have very limited time, I will not explain in details how we recasted these analyses. I just want to say that for open channel searches, we based our study on analyses by CMS that look for large DEDX. For closed channel searches, we based our analysis on ATLAS resonance diphoton search. And we also did open channel searches for the metal experiment using our own simulation. Now I'll show you the results. So the results have a form of two-dimensional planes. Since there is a charge of a particle, on y-axis there is a mass of new particles, which correspond to log the experiments will be able to provide at the end of data taking period. The gray, the area in gray should be already tested casting run to data. Now there are several curves. The red curve is the open channel search by Atlas and CMS. And as you can see, it changes moderately with the charge. The blue curve is the closed channel search that is not sensitive to low charges, for larger charges and become the dominant one. The green curves correspond to the metal experiment. It always increases with charge and generally provides intermediate sensitivity. You can curves. The most top one is corresponds to detection of one event, then two events, three events. We can speak about such low numbers because MEDAL is background-free experiment. It's for to those that maybe haven't heard about it, it's a mostly passive detector located in LHCb cavern, 2 meters away from intersection point 8. It was primarily designed to search for magnetic monopoles, but it can also detect long-lived particles if they are highly ionized. So on the next slide, I provide you with results for colorless scalars, on the left for RUN3, on the right for high LUMI. And as you can see, RUN3, for charges from 1 to 5, the large DDX searches are most dominant, and for larger charges, the search for diphoton dominant, and we can expect limits like 550 GeV for charge 1 and for charge 8, 2.2 TeV. For high luminosity, the limits grow to be 600 GeV for charge 1 and 2.5 TeV for charge 8. Something very interesting happens for intermediate values of charges from charge 3 to charge 6. Metal becomes more sensitive than those large experiments like Atlas CMS. This is kind of surprising because Metal is a small experiment and it will operate at 10 times lower luminosity than those two. However, Metal is background free, so it does not suffer from increased background after going to high LUMI. And it can become here sensitive large experiments, which is kind of interesting. Limits for the colorless fermions are stronger. So for one, we expect 950 GeV during RUN3, and for charge 8, 2.3 TeV. And for high luminosity, for charge 1, it should be about 1 TeV, and for charge 8, 2.6 TeV. And again, we see that for intermediate values, metal becomes more sensitive than Atlas and CMS. While for colored scalars, limits are even stronger. So we have 1 TeV, 550 GeV for charge 1 during at the end of RUN3. And then for charge 8, we have 2.6 TeV. And for high LUMI, we have 1.61. And for charge 8, we have 2.9 TeV. Situation with metal is similar. And finally, colored fermions, here the bounds are strongest. So we can expect for charge 1 at the end of RUN3, 2 TeV, and for charge 8, it would be 2.8 TeV. And for high luminosity, we expect over 2 TeV for charge 1, and for charge 8, 3.1 TeV. More sensitive than Atlas or in for charges from 3 to 6. So to conclude, we can detect multiply charged heavy long-lived particles at LHC through open and closed channel searches. But if we want to correctly interpret our findings, we need to include, consider photon and photon gamma fusion processes to an appropriate PDF to calculate cross-section accurately. Now, when it comes to large experiments like ATLAS and CMS, then generally open channel searches are more sensitive for charges from 1 to 5, while for larger charges, the diphoton resonance searches become more sensitive. And when it comes to MEDAL, it provides a completely different method than ATLAS and CMS because it's background free and passive. And for round three, it provides intermediate sensitivity for all charges. While what is interesting for HiLumi, we expect that MEDAL can become more sensitive than ATLAS and CMS for intermediate value of charges from 3E to 6E, because mainly because it's background free experiment. And as you might have noticed, I showed you limits from those three analyzers. I didn't show you like a combined limit. And I think none of the experiments provided that, but I might be wrong. Seeing something like a combined limit from different searches, open and closed channel, would be very, very interesting. And before I finish, just wanted to mention that there has been a very recent result by ATLAS, a new large DEDX search was published in May, and an excess with 3.3 sigma significance has been observed that is interpreted as a longer particle. There was a talk about it and discussion 2 days ago at this workshop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rafael, for this nice talk. And we open the floor for questions. Because if not, I have to ask you the, okay, Mike is going to say something.
Yeah, just go ahead. Such heavy, high charge particles could affect G minus two of the muon. Has that been calculated, or does the muon G minus two give limits on these particles?
G minus two.
So any charged particles, especially highly charged ones in the loop diagram, can affect G minus two of the muon. But it probably is, if they're really heavy, that wouldn't be significant.
Well, but, uh-huh. But this is a simplified model, right? So
it's model. We want it to be as general as possible. So we only assume in our studies the quantum numbers of particles. And we vary their mass, and we vary their collider stable, or in case of MEDAL, we parameterize their decay length. So that would depend, I think, on the concrete model. We wanted instead give like a rough estimate what can be measured at round 3 LHC and HiLumi. Then if you have like a concrete model, you can kind of like know what to expect. Does that answer your question, or?
Yeah, pretty well, I guess, yeah. But I don't know if it's been calculated, G minus two.
So maybe Albert wants to say something about this or something different, I don't know.
I want to ask something different, just as a follow-up on the remark you made on the session on DDX we had 2 days ago. Would metal be sensitive to what possibly ATLAS is seeing? Maybe, you know, the luminosity is still low, but for metal, because we have only the luminosity, but as a signature, would you see that in your plastic?
In order for metal to be sensitive, the particle has to be really long-lived. It has to traverse at least 2 meters. The detector is 2 meters away from intersection point, and it has to be highly ionizing. Now, maybe it would be. This has to be checked.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I think it has a chance. There is a chance, but like. There's still ongoing discussion what actually, how to interpret this result. Right? There is this thing that
they are apparently not, that they are close to beta equal one or so, and that probably you would not see so easily.
Yes. You are right. So, okay, I've have to check.
Okay. But it's good to look at it maybe once within the collaboration.
Mm-hmm. No, actually, yeah, I wanted to show you this plot. It's in the backup. Actually, you are right. So metal is sensitive only to slowly moving particles. So if you, this data suggests this particle should be like around charge one or charge two. For charge two, the particle has to move low, not more than 30% of speed of light to be detectable at that metal. So if their data suggests like beta equal one or but also this other measurement that's such as 0.6, if I remember correctly, then it's still like beyond metal's reach. Metal has this peculiar property that it's sensitive only to slowly moving particles.
Okay, thank you very much for this estimation. I think for more refined estimates, you can always use the Mattermost channel. But then I would like to close the session here because we have the snow mass coming and we can start on time at 5:45 certain time. So we thank Rafael and all the speakers of the session again, and we reconvene at 17:45.
Thank you.